Okay, good afternoon once again. CanadianOrthodoxBroadcasting.ca here at the Canadian Orthodox Monastery. And Ron Dart and I were going to talk a little bit about C.S. Lewis. And Laura, I'm going to interview Ron Dart a little bit about C.S. Lewis. Ron teaches regularly at the university and comes into more contact with these ideas. But C.S. Lewis is very much valued by certain religious groups and elements and social groups and elements because of the way he, in his writings, among other things, we have drama and adventure, but we always have the triumph of courage and the good and virtue. And not surprisingly, J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis were colleagues and actually have formed an organization together, and both of them wrote in that same vein. J.R.R. Tolkien was Roman Catholic, and C.S. Lewis was began as an atheist and slowly became a Christian after a while. There are a couple of things about C.S. Lewis that perhaps you could shine some light on. His use of the Tao, the idea of Tao, in it as I understand, a kind of a moral system or moral structure. But it's really rather odd, it seems to me, the use of this idea of Taoism or the Tao.
Well, yeah, you mentioned that because that's really the appendix to his short little book, The Abolition of Man. Mm-hmm. And The Abolition of Man, Lewis was very concerned that with the coming to be of a certain type of liberalism, morals would be so relativized that no one could speak of what was right or wrong or good or better or best or bad, worst, worse. And what was happening at Oxford, Cambridge, and on the continent at the time and other places was the dimming of any sort of ethical standards. And The Abolition of Man, which is interesting, a book I talked to Sheila Grant a few years ago before she died, and George Grant died in 1988. George and Sheila were at Oxford at the time that The Abolition of Man came out with Lewis, and they were both very involved in the Socratic Club. And what Lewis was doing in The Abolition of Man, in the appendix called the Tao, he said, on the one hand, we have this increasing fraying of ethics, in which no one will be able to stand on their feet anymore and say, this is right, this is wrong, or this is good, or this is better, or this is best. In the appendix, he says, let's track all the great civilizations of the past and see if there's a sense of an ethical standard by which they all concur and agree to. And so he goes into Egyptian civilization, an Indian civilization, a Chinese civilization, the Tao. And as he goes through each of these great religious ethical systems, he takes the position that all the sacred civilizations of the past held that there is a standard, and to the degree we know that standard and attune ourselves to that standard, we are truly free to live a good life. And so for what Lewis was doing, the Tao for him was really just an use of an Asian word to articulate the Western understanding of natural law. Okay, there's something that we all share in common, as opposed to those who would say we share nothing in common, and that standards are purely private and individual, and no one can legislate right from wrong, it's purely relative. So I think what he's doing with the Tao, it's a reply to the fragmentation of ethics in the modern, we could say also in the postmodern world, with him within Cambridge and Oxford at the time.
Yeah, I think sometimes when I look at C.S. Lewis, I also think of Hobbes' Leviathan, and think that often I think Hobbes is a little bit misunderstood. I don't think he should be placed in on the dark side with John Calvin and others, because in the Leviathan, Hobbes is talking about something similar, that you have to have an organizing authority that brings together the disparate interests and gives some kind of possibility of some kind of civilized and peaceful intercourse among people, some what we would call nationhood, where people are somehow cooperating where they wouldn't be otherwise, but that this Leviathan is the organizing authority over it. And it seems to me that C.S. Lewis saw something of the necessity of a spiritual organizing force. force more than a politically organizing force.
Yeah, Lewis would argue, unless there's not some commonality that you share that has been given to us from the great classical tradition and through other great civilizations, sacred civilizations, then what you're into what Yeats called the center cannot hold, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world.
Yeah.
And so Lewis is very interesting in that most who just know Lewis superficially would have been exposed to him through Chronicles of Narnia, the children's story, or as an apologist through the BBC, Mere Christianity. But Lewis was essentially a medieval, a Renaissance scholar. He saw the beginning of the end of Christendom with the coming to be of the Reformation, which he tended to see as the deformation of Christianity. And so what's happened, though, since the late 1950s is some leading thinkers from Wheaton College, which is somewhat called the Vatican of the Evangelicals, got very interested in C.S. Lewis. And so Clyde Kilby and there were others, and they began to bring a lot of the archives to the United States. Lewis, Dorothy Sayers, Charles Williams, Tolkien, all of this group. And so Americans came to think that, oh, if Lewis's works and all this group are at Wheaton, Lewis must have been an evangelical, which of course he was the farthest thing in the world from an evangelical or even a Calvinist. He saw these as serious distortions of Christianity. But Lewis in North America has come to be seen as an apologist for the Reformed and evangelical world, where some of his greatest writings defend the classical tradition, you know, whether it's 16th century literature, excluding drama, the discarded image. You can go on and on with these works. And so and this, I think, which makes Lewis particularly interesting to many of the Orthodox, because Lewis was dipping his bucket in a deep subterranean stream of the Fathers, and of course the Orthodox tradition is grounded in the Fathers. So would you see that as some of the areas of
conflict? Well, that's one reason why he's of interest to the Orthodox Christian, to a lot of Orthodox people. And one thing is that when one goes beyond his more popular writings. I mean, more popular writings can be, okay, a good image of triumphs, and courage is held at given a high value. But the other thing about Lewis that strikes me is his interest in virtue as part of the educational system, an education toward virtue, something that's almost completely missing in modern education. And by perhaps a misunderstanding of virtue is thinking, you know, people running around with chastity belts on or something. But virtue, arete, the perfecting of one's abilities, skills, and talents in a positive rather than negative way, and which is the real meaning of virtue. And he really was concerned that that should be an integral part of the educational system and of the way you bring up people with that idea of virtue as a goal, as something that one worked toward.
Yeah, and arete, we just get a word aristocracy, the rule of the noble people who are willing to, and a lot of his more popular works are, in fact, is how do we overcome our false self, our false face, through struggle with grace, which in Orthodox or Catholic Anglicanism, which Lewis was, synergism. How do we participate with God in becoming who we're meant to be? And those are aristocrats of the soul, or aristocrats of virtue, and the notion that at our noblest, to the degree we're willing to let go of what we are not to become what we're meant to be, that's what an aristocrat, a spiritual aristocrat,
supposedly, and perhaps once upon a time. But that is the whole thing. I think the misunderstanding of what virtue is might be a little bit of a part of a problem, because what is the virtue that we're striving toward as human beings is not just to maintain a moral code or a moral law or be gooder than most, but to be the best that a human being can be. Not say the best that I can be, but the best that a human being can become. That this is my advancement toward perfection, which is what God has called us toward, my advancement toward perfection, is in behalf of the whole of humanity, the whole of human race. That is not to make myself better than others, but to fulfill, really, the fulfillment of the actual calling of the human being, of the actual possibilities as a human being. That would be more, in any case, I see that as a kind of virtue that C.S. Lewis would call people.
Yeah, and I think what's happened is the language of the virtues and vices have been co-opted by Puritanism, so they become ethical codes, whereas arete and the classical virtues and vices are about knowing yourself, knowing your nature in that classical sense of phusis, and perfection, even the language of, when Christ says, be perfect, the word there is the word that, do you know yourself and are you living out of who you're meant to be in the deepest sense of the world? And all of sin is, hamartia, is missing the mark of who you're meant to be as a human being. So it's an ontological term, not ethics in a lower level. It's more about, are you becoming who you're meant to be at the most significant and deeper level? And if you're not, that's what sin is. It's not misdeeds and misdemeanors in a Puritan sense.
Yeah, well, I wonder, and perhaps you know, certainly, better than I would, whether Lewis actually had come up against this idea that the problem of the concept of morality and ethics has perhaps a roadblock toward virtue, in the way of virtue itself, that we have a static system of rules that when we fulfill that was fine, but not necessarily rising beyond that, where those things weren't even necessary themselves, because that was toward the perfection of mankind, was that we surpassed concepts of morality and ethics and went to something higher.
Well, this is where, as we mentioned in the conversation, we started with the abolition of man. Lewis is very wary, on one hand, of the relativizing of ethics. On the other hand, he was very worried of the Puritans who wanted to reduce ethics to a moral code.
Yeah.
So this via media, or this middle way, was what the virtues, or arete, or know your nature, was all about. And in all of Lewis's writings, both his academic writings and his more popular works of fiction, he's constantly exploring this meaning of aristocracy of the soul, what the difference between virtue and vice is in terms of our being and who we're meant to become. And so, yes, so be wary of Puritanism, which emerges with the 16th century, on the one hand, and be wary of relativism on the other. And between Puritanism and relativism, there's the great vision of who we are by nature and how we come to know ourselves, and how often we forget who we are because of a whole range of internalized or external expectations.
Yeah, it seems to me that Puritanism breeds relativism, because Puritanism is building a fence and a wall around something, and it's within our context. Okay, once this is within your context, then this can be within my context, and we're not trying to search out what the ultimate destination or goal is. We're trying to preserve a system that's relative to us as Puritans, but then people who are not Puritans, well, okay, but relative to us. and in a way, that kind of freezing something, the way the Puritans have said. The only way you can actually deal with it is in a relativistic way.
Yeah. Because relativism is a reaction to Puritanism in many ways, just as Puritanism is a reaction to relativism.
Yeah.
And there is a much more substantive middle way of understanding virtues, nobility. And this is what Lewis and many of the great theologians of faith are grappling with. But you get this lesser debate between relativism and Puritanism, which the great women and men who have thought these are trying to raise the discussion to a more substantive and meaningful level.
Yeah, and there were authors like Lewis and Tolkien as well, who are actually, through the things they're writing, trying to explore these ideas of discovering yourself and discovering who you are and discovering. Even Albert Camus, the one thing that strikes me in the plague, I don't know if you read the plague, it's in this catastrophe of the plague that little by little these individuals discover a meaning to life that's beyond themselves and that involves other people. And really, in the plague, it's really about discovering that as a human being, I actually become more virtuous by taking responsibility and by discovering what my relationship with other human beings is. And I mean, Camus wouldn't have been exploring that from earlier. It just pointed you, of course. But there's a great deal to be said for that. As these various people in the plague in the city are discovering something beyond themselves, and they're coming to have a greater value through their relationship and their response to other people, and in many cases other people suffering, and that this is a kind of beginning of the discovery of what virtue actuality really is coming to the fulfillment of what our humanity is really all about, as humanity.
It's interesting, too, you mentioned Tolkien, and Lewis and Tolkien were a group called the Inklings, and in a couple of weeks, Tolkien's The Hobbit is hitting the theater December 14th. Very interesting, in The Hobbit, one of the key figures in the Hobbit, anyway, is Bilbo Baggins, who lives in the Shire, and he has two family backgrounds. The Baggins, which are all about security and protecting himself and not taking chances and risks, and the Tookish side of the family, which was about risk and adventure, and are you willing to leave behind the comfort, the predictable, the secure, to go out into something that you're not sure about, which would be the faith journey, and
there and back again.
And so really, when you think of this being, non-being, or virtue, most people are always torn inside. Are they going to give themselves security, predictability, comfort, or will they be open to adventure, risk, challenge? And it says the wizard Gandalf comes and knocks on the door, and the dwarves start coming in. That Bilbo has to make a choice. Will he capitulate to the secure and predictable, or will he go on the great journey there and back again? And that's very much a story that Tolkien is exploring about nobility of character or shrinking character.
Yeah, in Bilbo's case, there's a lot of physical adventure, but there's also mental, emotional adventure that we should open ourselves up to. And that's part of what the decision that Baggins has to take. First of all, is to be open to the other and be open to the possibility that there's something beyond what he's experienced and knows. And that's emotional and mental, philosophical as well as physical adventure.
Most of the Hobbits, really, it's really about how an external event challenges us internally and how we respond internally to the external challenge. And it's interesting, much of The Hobbit, Bilbo is put with dwarves who he just does not get along with, and he has to somehow stay with them. And so the wizard, in terms of Bilbo's own transformation, or in Christian tradition's deification in that sense, is about being put in the company of people who he's constantly irritated by, who ignore him, who treat him indifferently, who badmouth him, who caricature him, and yet they have to go find the gold, and somehow he has to stay with the dwarves, even though the dwarves have problems with him and he with them.
Yeah, and they work it out. But this is part. Trying to find out what to prevent. First of all, what is the vocation of our humanity? And it seems to me these particular writers are trying to explore what the vocation of our humanity, but then also trying to rise to that vocation is the process of virtue as well. And of course, our concept of that is through Christ. Other people have a different concept of it, but nevertheless, trying to find the real vocation of humanity and what it is to be human, an actual human being, as opposed to being just a gorilla with vocal cords. You know, it's that's part of what Lewis is, in my view anyway, understanding. Yeah. Part of what Lewis is exploring.
Yeah, and Lewis stood very, very much within that great Christian humanist tradition, that brought together the wisest and the most insightful and the best that had been articulated both in the Western tradition and also in the great religions of the world. And he was involved in his different way in synthesizing these in his work against what he saw as the fragmentary nature of the modern world, which was dissolving any standard or center or core that could hold us together. So he was very prophetic. Like he saw where the West was going, and he tried to articulate an alternate way through his academic works, through his popular writings, through his fiction, through his science fiction, a whole range of different genres he used to raise the question, what does it mean to live a meaningful, noble life? The same things Camus exploring, but obviously within a Christian
framework. But nevertheless, you know, you couldn't really. I mean, Camus had an idea which had a certain universality to it, particularly in that particular novel. And I can see the same kind of basic idea in Lewis as well. That what is the vocation of my humanity ultimately? And in Camus, until you take responsibility for what your vocation is, you're a non-person. And in C.S. Lewis too, this is the ascent in virtue, is taking responsibility for the vocation of your vocation as a human being, the vocation of humanity itself. And so these ideas, and I think Lewis had the grasp that these ideas had a universality to them, because all human beings, all societies, all cultures are grappling with human problems, and humans are basically the same. We have the same human nature, so naturally we came to some of the same conclusions or similar conclusions. And there is a kind of universality in those approaches to the human condition in it. And they cross many boundaries. But the loss of these concepts is something that really then devalues our humanity, or devalues our calling as human beings. Devalues our vocation of humanity.
Yeah, and what? I mean, I think the comparisons you're making are very good, in that both Camus and Lewis come out of a humanist tradition at its best. Obviously, in Camus, you get a bit of the dimming of the religious, whereas in Lewis, it's very explicit. And Camus is known as one of the great existentialists, right? As an existentialist just means existere. You step out into who you're meant to be, and take responsibility for who you're meant to be. And in that sense, both Lewis and Camus are existentialist humanists. Mm-hmm. Lewis is more explicit in his commitment to the Christian tradition, but he has a breadth about him that Camus also had, and a commitment to life, because Camus entered the big struggles of his time with France and Algeria, and these large issues, his novels, as you mentioned.
And losing one of his lungs to tuberculosis in the midst of it all. But I sometimes think we push aside, say somebody would say, oh, Camus was an atheist, can't read him, and C.S. Lewis was a Christian, so I can read him. However, we're missing a whole dimension of the human formation that way, because both of them, in a way, are looking towards something. And we would assert that the gospel maybe have the answers that Camus was looking for as well. But nevertheless, what he's expressing is that this is part of the human condition, is trying to find out what it means to be human. What it means to have this vocation of humanity. It seems to me that Camus is interested in that, as Lewis is, only from different aspects.
Yeah, and I would prefer a Camus who is non-religious, but is really trying to grapple with these deep human issues where there's suffering and tragedy, than someone who claims to be religious but is not engaged in the big issues of life. Because one uses the language of religion as a form of escapism, and someone like Camus or Marx or these others, they're reacting to the distortion of religion, and there's a health in their reaction. Now, you want to take them further down the path, but you want to say your reaction to this shallow, domesticated, sanitized religion is simply not healthy, and to fight against it's a sign of health. Now, good thinkers, like Lewis and many others, are saying, good for you people who react to shallow religion, but there's more to religion than the shallowness you're reacting to.
Well, mere religion. So, but part of what I was getting at, of course, I say the words prayer, and I, uh, I acknowledge the symbol of faith. Doesn't mean I try to live it, but I acknowledge it, you know, so I'm a Christian. And Lewis was calling on us to go a great deal beyond that. And Camus was looking for that path also. And perhaps, you know, sometime we could offer it if we would.
Well, it's interesting, he concludes the last battle, which is the seventh book of Chronicles of Narnia, that there were some in the last battle who didn't acknowledge Aslan, but they didn't explicitly, but implicitly in their lives and fighting for the good, they were Aslan's people.
Yeah.
And so the last battle concludes with these big questions of some who claimed to be following Aslan didn't in the last battle, some who didn't know Aslan but fought for the good were closer to Aslan. This is what...
Those were actually his followers.
That's right.
And of course, sometimes there are non-Christians who follow an example of Christ who come far closer to Christ than some Christians do.
Oh, absolutely.
As well. And we need to acknowledge that. So, anyway, our time is up, and we thank you very much for joining us. And we'll continue discussions. Ron and I do these broadcasts regularly, and we hope you'll join us in future for these broadcasts. And thank you all, and God bless you.